WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for The Morning Show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to be welcoming back into our studios two faculty colleagues from Carthage College, Jeffrey Roberg, who is chair of the Political Science Department. I think you're chair anyway. You have been, and as far as I know, you're continuing to bear those responsibilities cheerfully, professor of political science there, and Penny Seymour, who is professor of neuroscience at Carthage. And the two also happen to be husband and wife. In fact, have been with us on The Morning Show at least once before. I can't remember if it's been more than that, but at least once. And are joining us again today to talk about their most recent trip to Cuba, or Cuba, as it is actually more properly pronounced. They have been there before on a couple of different occasions, and specifically went back on the heels of a relatively recent visit with Carthage students, primarily to examine the expansion of tourism in Cuba. And of course, with this nation suddenly very much in the headlines again in a way that it has not been in a number of years because of certain intentions announced by the Obama administration to draw our nations a bit closer together after decades and decades of icy estrangement, it means that a discussion of Cuba could not be more timely. So I'm really excited about this opportunity. So Professor Roberg, Professor Seymour, you welcome both of you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having us.
Good to have both of you here. Are one of you more responsible than the other for this particular line of work which you've been engaged in, namely going to other countries and examining the effect of tourism on the country and its citizens? With whom did this begin, or has this been kind of a mutual pursuit from the start?
I would argue that it began with Penny.
I would say that it probably began as a mutual pursuit of being able to figure out how to do a line of research together and travel at the same time. So it's really hard to say where it began because both of us have a love of travel.
Right. And this was one way to do that and engage in. And of course, I suppose the more I think about it now, examining the tourism in another country and the way that country is affected, transformed both on the national level and on the level of the individual citizen, that really involves each of you in your own academic disciplines, at least to some extent. Can we just start there by talking about the way in which each of you, given who you are and where you come from academically, how this study makes sense?
Well, my background is in neuroscience, but I have a healthy dose of psychology in that as an undergraduate. And as a grad student, I was in a biological psychology program. And so I look at tourism on the effects of people and how it's affecting their social structure, how it's affecting them individually. In Argentina, I looked at how the effects of tourism were actually affecting the human rights and the land rights of some indigenous people. In Cuba, there are no indigenous peoples now. That was taken care of centuries ago. Mm. But there are still vast divisions among people there because tourism brought in money for certain people but not for other people. And so you can see big differences among people as to how much money they may have to spend on food or on other supplies. But you also see that there are real divisions between rural and people who live in cities too. And so the rural life in Cuba appears not to have changed a lot from what I've seen, whereas city life appears to have changed quite a bit.
So you are really interested in the way in which the way people live their lives is altered, and or the way they maybe see themselves or feel about themselves and how they fit in? Is that the kind of thing you would examine?
Right, and how they feel about tourists coming in. Mm. And tourists, if they're coming into Cuba, they have money. And many Cubans, most Cubans, don't have money. And so how do they feel about people with money? It was the same thing I saw in Argentina, working with very impoverished indigenous people, that the people who were coming in to look at them and to buy their handicrafts were people who had enough money to travel to Argentina.
Hmm. Jeff, how about you? What is the political science side of this, or is it not as directly relevant as we might think?
No, this is a very easy link for me. So I was originally trained as a Sovietologist and lived in the old Soviet Union. And the work I was doing there was, of course, political economic analysis of the old Soviet Union and particularly human rights types issues as well. So in 2002, it was a conversion for me towards Latin America, and that was my first visit with a study tour to Cuba. So the kinds of questions that I'm looking at typically are not only as Penny is in terms of how people's lives are affected, but I'm also looking at the political economic effects on individuals, towns, cities, and of course the larger regime. And that is that all of these effects that Penny was talking about will have a further effect on the regime in Cuba, and whether the government likes it or not, there are changes taking place there, and there will be future changes taking place the more we open up and engage with Cuba. Which, go ahead.
And I suppose one of the things you examine also is, in a sense, the transactions which allow, for instance, tourism to explode in a given land. I mean, who is the government talking to, and why, and by what means, and what
sure.
What are the discussions going on, often behind closed doors, I should think, that allow this kind of development to occur at the pace it does.
And, of course, just general policy. So in 2012, there were about 98,000 U.S. citizens that visited Cuba, another 350,000 Cuban Americans. That starts, of course, with the U.S. government side of things, saying who can go, who cannot go. And as your listeners know, there have been a variety of restrictions through the Treasury Department, through the Office of Foreign Assets Control, that allowed or did not allow certain classifications of people to go to Cuba. And if they were allowed to go to Cuba, what they were allowed to spend while in Cuba. And therefore, there were limits put on U.S. citizens in an attempt to not support, was the argument, not support the Cuban regime, the Cuban government as such. Mm-hmm. Obviously, those changes are a lot of things have changed right now, although we're still very much in process and frankly, have a long road to walk still.
Right. If there's going to be a new age here, or new chapter where it's in its infancy, certainly, really,
yes.
Not much has been written yet. I wonder if you could, Jeff, give us a little bit of a historical long view, although in the grand span of history, this is scarcely a drop, but I think I'm really thinking of this long period of icy relations between the United States and Cuba. Remind us of exactly what we're talking about. I mean, what happened when that led to this diplomatic distance, shall we say, between the two nations, even though we're such close neighbors? And what I'm ultimately leading to is, over the span of those many years, has the relationship in terms of Americans being able to visit Cuba, how dramatically has that changed over the span of that time? I mean, mm-hmm. for instance, in the early going, was essentially nobody allowed to travel to Cuba. Did nobody want to go to Cuba? And how different has that become over the years, over the decades?
Sure. So We won't take the full view, but we'll take a partial view, and that is when the U.S. gets involved, it's the Spanish-American War. So end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. The Cubans were fighting for independence from Spain. For the historical record seems to suggest that they would have gotten it without our aid. We showed up, shall we say, helped them obtain independence, so to speak. And then, of course, the train is set on the tracks for basically the next 50 years of U.S. involvement in Cuba, having to do with sugar imports and exports. We had a large quota where we bought a lot of their sugar, made them rather dependent on the United States. By the way, should as a caveat, the Soviets did a similar type thing when as well once the U.S. left. We go from colonial master to colonial master, if you will.
Lucky Cuba.
Yes. Fast forward, we have we can come back to some things if you like, but we have Batista in power, he is eventually overthrown in 58. We have a revolution, end of 58. 59, the Cuban Revolution is successful. Fidel Castro comes to the United States, meets with Richard Nixon, who's vice president at that time. That does not go well. Frankly, Richard Nixon was probably the wrong person to meet, but President Eisenhower wasn't particularly disposed well to Cuba at that time either. Mm. And so the embargo, or the blockade as the Cubans call it, begins in October of 1960. And it's begun by President Eisenhower includes everything except for food and medical supplies at that time. That is an answer to it begins because U.S. company in Cuba refused to refine oil in Cuba of a Soviet shipment of oil. The Cubans nationalized that company, as well as a couple of other companies. Then there's a retaliatory action in terms of the embargo by the United States. In retaliation for that, the Cubans nationalize more property, we call it a day. Mm. And so then under Kennedy, you have a further advancement of the embargo in 62. Then we have, the quick version is a variety of legislation, depending upon what year we're talking about, particularly in the 90s, that toughen the regulations quite a bit until President Obama, 2009, we have a loosening of it, not the embargo, but at least travel restrictions on U.S. citizens being able to go to Cuba, as well as remittances from Cuban Americans being able to send those back to their families in Cuba.
So there have been generally speaking, the arc has been towards a loosening of those restrictions.
But that's really only since 2009.
Hmm. So, for instance, in 1967, if a given American for some reason wanted to travel to Cuba, as far as you know, it was essentially impossible?
Not impossible. There have always been certain categories of folks that have been allowed to travel there. And there is one exception, and that is in 1977. The rules before were such that the president had to reauthorize them every 6 months or so to put this back on. President Carter let them lapse, so there was some loosening in terms of travel from 77 basically till about 1982 when President Reagan put the screws back on.
So the restrictions were allowed to lapse.
Yes.
For
but
a brief
time. not the full embargo as such.
Exactly. And I should think that that would have a major effect, although it wouldn't be the only factor involved, in whether or not there's tourism of any significance at all in Cuba. I suppose other people from other places can travel to Cuba, even if Americans can't.
Yeah, we need to be kind of careful in terms of how we talk about this. So if we're talking about U.S. tourism, that is still restricted. In the past there were 12 categories that allowed that you could travel to Cuba under. One of those would be research like Penny and I have done. or education or such. And even those have been restricted over time. However, the rest of the world has not acknowledged those restrictions. So, for instance, last year, Cuba had about 2.8 million tourists visits to Cuba, and that represents about $2 billion, give or take. So, you know, particularly number one tourists are Canadians and Europeans and, of course, some Latin Americans as well.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Jeff Rohlberg, a political science professor at Carthage College, and Penny Seymour, who is a neuroscience professor at Carthage. They are just back from their most recent visit to the nation of Cuba, and specifically there to follow up on a trip in 2013 or 2014. Back for what amounted to a research expedition, if you will, to really even more closely examine the changes wrought by increasing tourism. So Penny Seymour, my understanding is your first trip, the two of you, to Cuba was in 2004.
Yes, it was.
And so you've been there now a couple of different times, but essentially a decade separated that early visit with this most recent one. In a nutshell, how dramatic? Jumping the gun a little. Tell us kind of the nature of what these trips were. I mean, when you went to Cuba, what exactly were you going there to do, and how did you do it?
Okay, in 2004, we took a group of Carthage students and community members to Cuba for one of the study tours in January, and we were looking at the effects of politics and the economy and also people's lives, especially the stress on people's lives in 2004. And we took the trip out of Havana because Havana is unlike many other parts of Cuba. And so we traveled across the island. So we traveled to Santa Clara, which is up in the mountains and has a prestigious university there. And we visited the university. Our students got a chance to talk with university students there. We went on to Trinidad, which is a Caribbean city. It's one of the oldest cities, Spanish cities, in the Western Hemisphere. And there we met some Cubans, and we got invited to have dinner in a paladar, a little home restaurant. And at that time, they really weren't legal, but several of us went. We went a couple of times and actually formed a relationship with the owner of the restaurant. And we went on to some other sites. And our students, we went to Playa Jirón, which is Bay of Pigs. And so we looked at history, and we looked at how people were living. And so we went back in 2014 with another group of students and community members, and we followed the same route. And we were really amazed at some of the changes, especially in Trinidad, which was celebrating, they were celebrating the 500th anniversary of the founding of Trinidad. Hmm. And this was a sleepy little community where people got around by riding donkeys or, you know, carts, you know, horse-drawn carts and whatever. And we arrive in Trinidad, and there's paladar after paladar. They're no longer hidden in people's homes. They're legal. They're all over. They're advertised with neon lights and flat-screen televisions. And there's somewhere around 100 paladars now in Trinidad. This was last year, and we're absolutely amazed at the changes that were occurring. And so we sought out this older man whose place we'd eaten at, and he said, yeah, I can't even compete anymore, so I closed mine. And so he actually invited our students into his home and talked about the history of Cuba and what it was like during the revolution. And so we thought to ourselves, well, if it's not just the paladars, it's all of these other things. There's ice cream shops. There's things where, you know, there's things to do here that just didn't exist 10 years before. And we'd seen some changes in Havana also, and that's when we decided to come back and actually start examining what was happening. And so we decided to do it on our own because it's hard to do research when you've got 18 students along with you. And we also wanted to look at some other areas in Cuba also besides just this route that we had taken previously.
It sounds like you were amazed at what you saw. So in a sense, I suppose you were in no position to have expectations of this change, or did you have some semblance even before getting there that some of this kind of change had occurred? I mean, I'm not sure to what extent Cuba has remained closed that it would be hard for us as Americans to even be aware of some of these drastic changes. I mean, truly, did you have no sense that it would be as changed as it was?
Well, I would say that, I mean, certainly from 2004 to 2014, that was unexpected. We just, again, and Penny's absolutely right. Havana is its own kind of animal. It's a big city, and it definitely has its problems. But it you know, on at least on the face of it, it looks like a city, and you recognize it, and it is what it is. These changes that took place in Trinidad were extremely dramatic. Now going back this year, so it's only been 12 months. Obviously, the changes were not so dramatic this time. We knew what we were coming into, but we went a little bit. We did a little bit different thing this time, which is normally when we have traveled or taken the students and community members in the past, we've stayed in hotels, and this time around, the two of us stayed in Casa Particulares, which is essentially people's homes. They rent out a room. And it was really just a fantastic way to see Cuba, especially because of all the conversations we could have off the radar. In people's homes, there's a much different conversation that takes place there than when you have a government minder in the background. We got to explore and do the type of research we wanted to do in terms of, why did people decide to rent out a room or whatnot? And this is something that's exploded as well in Trinidad and other locations, and even in Havana, this is going on too. And it's a coping mechanism of how to deal with an economy that doesn't necessarily let you live at the moment. And the best example I can give is, so a normal government salary is about $20 a month, okay? Mm. If you are renting out your home, a room, you can charge typically somewhere between, there's a conversion problem, but for sake of ease, we'll say $20 to about $40.
Wow.
Okay.
That
transforms your life. And you have to pay a tax, of course, and the tax is quite steep. But even after tax, this is a huge change for these folks. And so more and more people in a variety of areas have opened up their houses to travelers. And we also see that in terms of restaurants and restaurant workers or even workers within a house. So a lot of these houses have cleaning people. Or folks they've hired to do the cooking for breakfast or things like this. And when you think about, so I said, going back for your listeners, that the average wage is about $20 a month, these casas are paying their workers, in one example, would be $1 a day. Okay. That's a lot of money, in comparison, when you're trying to, that $10 difference. Or more, depending upon where we're talking, that can, again, change people's lives. And that comes into really Penny's and my work in terms of what are the changes that are going on. For me, it's what is this going to mean for the regime, right? If you don't have to depend on the regime for your livelihood, that opens up a lot of a lot of possibilities for you. And a lot of possibilities for U.S.-Cuban relations.
And as far as the government's concerned, the kind of possibilities that are probably very worrying. I mean, liberating potentially for citizens, but I should think a source of concern for a totalitarian government.
It's a catch-22, and that is that Raul Castro and the Cuban regime recognize that changes have to be made, and they've been making these changes since about 2010, and some of them quite dramatic in terms of allowing restaurants and paladars and allowing the casas actually go back about 20 years, but they've really taken off over the last 10. And they recognize that, you know, they've had too many people on the government roll, and the original plan by Raul was to get rid of about 1.5 million people off the government roll. They had to back down on that because they had no place for them and they couldn't be absorbed. Now there's about just under 500,000 Cubans that are employed, quote-unquote, privately. But there's still a whole lot of folks on the government roll. And so on the one hand, the Cuban regime recognizes that they need this kind of activity to absorb labor force, to be able to come up with cash, and that they can, of course, tax or fee or whatnot. At the same time, they're trying to do it in a controlled fashion.
And the government's also making money off of these casas, and they're making money off of the paladars because they're charging. These owners have to pay taxes on what they're making, and they also have to have licenses. To give you an example, for one thing, the Casa de Particulars kind of ran under the radar for citizens for the United States because we were mainly put in hotels, large government-controlled hotels. But Europeans and Canadians have been staying in these places for years, and we stayed in two places that have been operating legally for 20 years. And one of them in Trinidad, which is a city of about 50,000, the owner of the casa there had been in business for 20 years and had a beautiful home, told us that there were at least 1,000 Casa de Particulars in Trinidad alone.
Wow.
Out of a city of 50,000 people.
Now, they sound like bed and breakfasts here
exactly
in America.
So.
And that's exactly what they are?
Yes.
Okay,
that's kind of how they function and so on. Can we talk for a moment about the hotels in which you essentially didn't stay? Maybe you stayed a night or two, but that's basically not where you were interested in staying this time around. But is there anything we should know about? I mean, are hotels also just springing up here and there and everywhere? And what do they look like? What kind of range of luxury are we talking about?
Do you want to take it? So the hotels are of a variety of range, and it depends what we're talking about. So there's an area that is northeast of Havana called Veradero, which has a variety of hotels and serves mostly a foreign tourist population, and particularly Europeans and some Canadians. It's basically a bunch of beaches where folks go to unwind or relax or whatnot. And the rules on hotels is even if there are new ones being built, and there aren't a lot right now, the rule is that you cannot, as a Hilton or as a Sheraton or something like that, just come on in and say, I'm going to build my own hotel and I'm going to own it myself. So there's a 51-49% rule in Cuba for foreign investment. That is, the Cuban state owns 51%. The partner, the international partner, owns 49%.
Wow.
And some of these contracts are written in that after a certain period, 10, 20 years, whatever it is, that the total ownership goes to Cuba.
Wow. So if there's a Hilton somewhere in Cuba, it's really more Cuban-owned than Hilton-owned.
Right. And there isn't a Hilton right now because of the restrictions on our side, but possibly so. I mean, certainly in December when the president first announced this rapprochement, certainly the hotel industry was going, maybe. I think what you're going to see more of is that, at least temporarily, right now Hilton and Sheraton has a larger company called Starwood. What they do is they come into hotels and they essentially run them under the Hilton or the Sheraton name, as it were. And you're going to see more of that. There are not a lot of hotels being built at this moment. There are certainly some being refurbished. There are also certainly some that are being constructed, but they've got a lengthy period, shall we say, where one hotel in Trinidad a year ago they had started kind of doing some construction. It was hard to see what they had done in the last year, but they're working on it, I suppose. So there are, and then as far as the hotels themselves that do exist in Havana, you have different levels from 2 to 5 star hotels, as well as elsewhere in the country as well. Not in every city, of course. So Trinidad has, I think, they're building their 4th hotel now. That'll be a 4-star that they're building. Typically, it's the hotels that have some kind of internet capability, and the some kind really needs to be in quotation marks, because you may or may not have access.
You have to rub 2 sticks together to sign.
Well, the way they do it is they have a card that you buy from the state that allows you 30 minutes or 1 hour of time online. And the card costs,
approximately $7 for 1 hour.
Wow.
And, you know, while we might be willing to pay that, and other tourists might be willing to pay that, if you think about that for the average Cuban, going back to the average salary we talked about, that's a non-starter.
Wow.
And you might spend the first 10 minutes of that hour waiting for some site to come up, so it's not speedy. One of the things, too, about Cuba, other than in Havana, is that most of the tourist hotels that were in existence were basically all-inclusive resorts, and they were not in town. They were outside of town. They might be 5 to 10 or 15 kilometers outside of city center. And that kept tourists isolated from locals. And so the only reason why we happened to meet this man in 2004 is we actually hiked into town and started talking to people. And so the newer hotels, some of them appear to be being built closer to town because that gives people access to go into restaurants now and into gift shops and into handicraft shops. But the main function was actually, you know, tourists can come to Cuba, but don't mingle that much with our people.
There was another component of that also was that Cubans were not allowed in the resort hotels themselves. And that just recently changed about 3 years ago or so. But before that, they were not allowed to access these. So on the one hand, you've got keeping the tourists or the foreigners away from the Cubans, and then you've got the Cubans being kept away from the foreigners.
Yeah, that even included the beaches at these resorts, and Cuba has some beautiful, beautiful beaches, and that's one of the reasons why it's a destination for tourists are these beaches.
What you're describing reminds me of a moment on a Disney cruise I took last December with my wife. It was a gift from some family members, and I don't remember where we disembarked on the one day, but someplace down in the Caribbean, and we were disembarked at the pier and shuttled to a place to get another shuttle, and then shuttled to this luxurious place, and we literally went over this huge overpass, which landed us eventually in this plush, luxurious setting. And I mean, it was such a striking visual representation of a reality that plays out in a lot of other ways.
Yes.
But just the fact that this place where it's luxurious at every turn was so dramatically sequestered from where the regular people lived is really striking. It sounds like, to an extent at least, that has played out that way in Cuba. I think you're saying less so now.
Well, it's interesting because what we had before was that you had a two-tier economic system, and it still exists to some extent. But What you had was a what we call the young, upwardly mobile communists who would get tourist dollars in their jobs. So those who worked in the tourist hotels or were members of, say, the tour guides and whatnot would get U.S. dollars or Canadian money or euros or whatever it is, and that would change the way that things are done for them, as opposed to those who lived in Cuban society in general. Cuban society in general, those folks did not have access to foreign currency as such. And so you get these two tracks of people and inequality very much on the line here.
Hmm. When you first said that you went to this trip and decided to not stay in hotels and so on, I thought, well, that's an odd choice, because shouldn't you be going there and doing what all tourists do if you want to really sort of trace that experience? But, of course, what you're describing is that many, many tourists do now exactly what the two of you did. And, in fact,
right,
you were, in a sense, about as close to the ground as tourists as you could probably possibly be in a place like Cuba.
Right, and we want to know, of course, what are the changes that take place with the casa owners and the restaurant owners or the restaurant workers, right, in terms of how their lives are changing because of the interaction with tourists. And so this was a natural thing for us. It was kind of difficult to put together from a U.S. perspective because in the past we've been required to deal with Havana Tour, which is the government essentially for making any plans. Again, as Penny mentioned, the Canadians and the Europeans are much more advanced than we are in terms of dealing with casas particulares and going outside the normal way of things, shall we say, with the government. And so this was a good way for us to really see what's going on.
Mm. I should think it would be fascinating on all kinds of different levels. And I suppose it really did make a big difference for you to have no students with you, in the sense, not that I don't want to mischaracterize your earlier trips as pleasure excursions where you were there to entertain your students and, you know, and the community members along. But on the other hand, there's has to be some component of obviously involved in a trip that involves expense and so on. But I'm sure it was, in a sense, a relief to not have to worry about any of that, to pepper the days with interesting activities and so on.
Yeah, it's hard to do research when you have a large group, because you're really responsible for the group and you can't go wander off on your own. But we do try and plan the activities so that they get a closer look at the country or the city or the region where we are, so that they have some background. And we also try and set up meetings for them with locals, with either government officials, with university professors, with students. We have now an ongoing relationship with this university in Santa Clara, and we actually went back privately to visit with this group. And some of our students from last year are still in email contact with students. So we're trying to form those long-lasting ties between the United States and Cuba at a very personal level. So we do that with students. But in this upcoming trip, one of the things that we did is that we talked to owners of Casa de Particulares about bringing in student groups. So some of them have rooms for only two bedrooms set aside. Some of them have as many as five or six, depending upon the size of the home. But they often work in groups of neighboring houses that offer rooms. And so they said, oh, well, we can take a group of 20 because we have that house there and that house there and that house there. And so we are looking at, for at least part of our next trip, of actually putting our students in these Casa de Particulares also, so that they can get this really on-the-ground look and that they can speak more freely with Cubans than being isolated in hotels.
And Penny just made this subtle plug. I'll make it more vocal here. And so we're going back in January, another study tour. And
this next coming January.
And as we mentioned, we often take community members with us. So if any of the listeners are interested, they can get in touch with one of us. And can't guarantee a spot this far out, but we can certainly put you on a list. Mm.
One of the things you examined in your work in Argentina was how a real disturbing amount of sort of displacement had occurred of, let's say, the native population in Argentina in this particular region that you were studying, and also a fair amount of environmental damage being done, which was also, of course, of great concern to you and to others. To what extent are those factors in place in Cuba in terms of what you are seeing with this explosion of development? Very much, or is this not a similar story in that respect?
So far, I will differentiate it a couple different ways, and that is that so far so good on the environmental side of things. So there are a number of areas where the Cuban government has designated them as national parks. And the good thing about being a good old-fashioned authoritarian system is folks, to a certain extent, must listen to those rules. That doesn't mean that there aren't folks doing under-the-table deals and whatnot. That's something different. But as far as some of the larger national park areas, environmental areas or such, they're quite controlled. What you don't typically see is building of a variety of hotels and whatnot on areas where the government doesn't want them. So let's start there. There are going to be issues coming forward, and that is that. So if we're talking about just the kind of environmental areas, there's some good, relatively good protections there. If we're talking about the environmental effects that tourists are going to have in Cuba, that chapter hasn't been written yet. And what I mean by that is there are going to be infrastructure issues. More tourists equals more trash, more sanitation problems, whether we're talking about sewer systems and treatment of waters and whatnot. And, of course, it also means more need for potable water, right? And then, of course, you've got other issues as well. So as tourism develops, as more and more people flood the island, you're going to have more problems creep up. And at this point in time, the government does not have the resources and perhaps not necessarily the inclination to deal with some of those at this time. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. I'm frankly a little leery of where we're going. Cuba is a less developed country. It already has a variety of needs that are not necessarily being met. In terms of just basic infrastructure, so Penny mentioned that we went to a couple of different areas out west this time. We rented a car drove west from Havana all the way to the western tip. And Cuba, unfortunately, does not have a very good transportation network. And what that means is when people need to get from town to town, place to place, they may have to wait hours or walk hours to get there. And there just aren't enough buses around. So we saw trucks and all sorts of other things that were conveying people. And there's a tradition in Cuba, a longstanding tradition, that says if you see a hitchhiker, you pick them up. And so we picked up, I don't know, about 10 folks or so and conveyed them there 15 kilometers or so and to wherever town they needed to be. You have a nice conversation, you say goodbye, and it's just expected that that's what you do. And so that's another one of those kind of issues that somehow has to be dealt with.
Yeah, one of the big problems with a lot of tourists coming in and looking at these, there's really stunning environmental areas there, is that the infrastructure of the roads are terrible. Mm. It's pothole after pothole, and into many of these areas you have very narrow two-lane roads, often across the mountains. And we see, like in Vinales, these big tour buses coming in one after another on these mountain roads where you're dodging potholes all the time. And
or not dodging potholes.
Or not dodging potholes. And you've got horse carts and oxen carts and bicycles and people walking and dogs there running alongside. And so heavy traffic is going to cause a real calamity coming into these areas. So Cuba's either going to have to improve their roads or really restrict how many people can come in.
Hmm. I'm reminded of a great line in Rick Steves' most recent book about traveling to Europe. I interviewed him about a week ago, and he said, with the rapid modernization of so much of even rural Europe, one of the frustrations is tourists come there, as they go to a lot of places, wanting to see the native woman with a jug on her head.
Yes. Yeah.
And they're more apt to see, you know, that native woman working in a Starbucks or wherever. And it sounds like we're talking about that, too. We're talking about dozens upon dozens of tourist buses sharing the road with the ox cart. And at some point, you sort of feel like that ox cart and what that represents, that whole lifestyle, is to probably some extent threatened by this, isn't it?
Well, I would argue that the ox cart will continue for a long time to come because that's based on agriculture. So particularly if you go out west, you will see tobacco field after tobacco field after tobacco field. And the tobacco fields are not what your listeners would know in the United States as large-scale farms. Mm. These tend to be small family farms. And then they're aggregated in some fashion for making the cigars that everybody loves.
Hmm.
And so you're going to continue to have these ox carts and whatnot because the oxen are doing the plowing and they're offering transportation, again, from town to town or whatnot. So those things are not going to change anytime soon, particularly if you think about it in terms of what it costs to buy a tractor.
Ah. Right?
And the cost to buy a tractor, no one can buy a tractor, not at least in farming. And so unless something drastically changes, say through foreign aid, right,
hmm.
or a new policy by the government of Cuba to make these kind of changes, those oxen carts are going to continue for a long time, and so will the horses and whatnot. And somehow we're going to have to figure out how to all live together.
Hmm. Well, what a fascinating moment in Cuba's history for you to visit. And I can well understand why you are so anxious to return with students and perhaps some community members as well in this coming January.
Correct.
So January of 2016. And you better believe we're going to want to have you back on the